Mr. Exner, since your triumph with the Fisher Body first place award in 1947?
46.
Sketch out your subsequent years for you.
Well, of course, I continued to go to high school, or went to high school shortly after that. I hadn't entered junior high even. I was 1940. I was 13 when I won it.
That's incredible. And, that was a junior division.
Yeah, that was a junior division, right. And of course, we were living in South Bend at that time, and I went up through junior high school. I was a sophomore in high school in South Bend when we, 1949, moved to the Detroit area, back to Birmingham. And I was enrolled and started in Cranbrook my last 2 years of high school at Cranbrook School. And graduated there in 1951. This was just right at virtually the time that my father's career was starting to blossom at Chrysler, and he had done already done some successful show cars there. And I always wanted to go into design, and my parents felt that it was best for me to probably pursue architecture, thinking that that would be or go to an architectural school, thinking that that would be a the best stepping stone, best preparation for car design. Now, at that time, you must realize that there were there still weren't any schools that were, except for more or less on a trade school basis, that really prepared a person for automotive design. Nothing profession as professional as an architectural schools. Nothing as professional as engineering schools of any kind, and certainly nothing with a true university background. And having always been influenced by my father, of course, and having lived in South Bend myself, and we liked South Bend very much, I elected to go to the University of Notre Dame. I started in the fall of 1951 at the University of Notre Dame. I might mention that up until that, during my time at Cranbrook, I participated in sports, lettered in football, in high school, and mm-hmm. in basketball. The family was always interested in sports, mm-hmm. and as well as received a couple of art awards myself.
You enjoyed Cranbrook?
I enjoyed it very much, yes. Very much. I liked being a boarding student. I liked being away from home, mm-hmm. And even though home was close by, I still had to respect the rules regarding that, and just really thoroughly liked it. This was great preparation for college, of course, as had been thought by my folks, and it's something that held me in good stead at university. So I went back to South Bend. Of course, we had friends there that I knew and whatnot, but not so many of my school friends as family friends. And my grandparents still lived nearby in Buchanan, Michigan. And I was quite at home there. For the first 2 years, I pursued architecture or architectural engineering. It had been recently made into a five-year program from two, when the time I started, it had been made into a five-year program made out of two four-year programs. One was architectural design and the other architectural engineering. It came under engineering. When I started out as a freshman, went through it in my freshman and sophomore years, the combined course of 5 years, which was a more or less an official American Institute of Architects program in major universities, and Notre Dame was well recognized for a very pretty fine architectural course. Very small in number, there were approximately 94 of us that started in architecture. in the freshman class. Notre Dame was a relatively small undergraduate school at that time of approximately 5,000. And it was, of course, Catholic run. I was still not Catholic in any way. Nevertheless, we started off with a class of about 94. And even myself, I dropped out of the architectural school by the end of my sophomore year because the engineering aspects of it were getting to me. I was having wonderful success artistically and design wise, and the head of the architecture school tried very hard to talk me out of transferring to fine art. I was having difficulties with statics, physics, and calculus all at once, I had a couple of failures there, decided that I really honestly did feel also that I wasn't getting enough art background. It was heavily into architecture, and it was really a course that they were going to make an architect out of you. That's all there is to it. And even though they knew that I was interested in car design, the head of the department, Mr. Montana, thought I'd make a wonderful architect.
What do you think, looking back on it?
Looking back on it, I guess I still love industrial design and car design, but that would have been fun. Yeah. And I had my trouble was that I tried to make buildings move, that was. Everything that I designed in the way of a building was looked like it was going 100 miles per hour. So I wound up transferring to fine art, and I still come back over to the architecture department where a lot of my friends were, and I would illustrate, draw in cars on there, some of the illustrations that they had to make, and do that kind of background work for them. But meanwhile, I pursued fine art, and I got much more within my element, more comfortable. And I started myself to promote transportation design. Every design problem that I had, I would turn it into a transportation problem. And I soon fell in with my professor there, Mr. Frederick Beckman, who was the head of the design department of the art department at Notre Dame. Took up quite an enthusiasm for my interest in car design himself. He had been, for the most part, tutored in advertising design. He didn't know too much about car design or industrial design, but he thought this was a neat opportunity because I was the son of the guy that was the head of, of Chrysler at design at Chrysler, and so and I openly pursued doing all of the. Getting him enthused in all of the car design work that I could, and several of the students took up quite an interest in that too. I took design courses, of course, and then I had the opportunity also to go to Europe for the first time because at the end of my junior year in 1954. Towards the end of my junior year for one semester, actually starting 1955, had the opportunity to go over to the University of Vienna and spend a semester there on a not on an exchange basis, but with the Institute of European Studies that offered this type of opportunity. And I was able to go to an art academy in Vienna, the Kunst an der Bildung Academy in Vienna, Austria. They're KUNST Art and Bildung Pictures, BILDDN Bildung Academy of Vienna, Austria, spent one cold winter there from February of. Early February of 1955 until August of 1955. Actually, in the school was from February until June, the one semester, got a great deal of travel experience as well as artistic tutoring on a personal basis.
Great experience.
Professors there. It was great. It was fantastic. It was really a great experience, and it built up my enthusiasm for Europe tremendously too. It was an education within itself. That fall, I returned to Notre Dame, and of course I'd wanted to build a car badly all of my life, or since the time I was a little kid. In fact, when I was a small kid, I built a great deal many Soapbox Derbies for both myself and my friends, and even organized. There were no official organized Soapbox Derby races in South Bend at that time, from 1943 to 49. It had been discontinued there. So I organized my own races, and with the kids in the neighborhood, built them cars, and had promoted the programs and everything else to do that sort of thing. I was just crazy about racing cars, of course.
Did you get down to Akron?
No, never did. It wasn't a banned thing. It was that the newspapers in those days sponsored the races, and they just didn't. They lost their sponsorship in South Bend during that period of time, so it was never officially promoted there at all. But later on, it became Chevrolet, of course. By the end of 1955, I returned for my senior year in 56 in Notre Dame. But by that time, I was talked my father into allowing me to build a car at home during the summer, he knew I wouldn't do anything else if I started to do this, but nevertheless he said, okay, well, I think we were crazy about sports cars and going to all the sports car meets, and it was getting very popular at that time, and I wanted to build a sports car. And so I worked during the summers when I was going to school. I worked in creative industries in Detroit as a draftsman 1 year, as a fiberglass worker another year, and I worked for Chrysler the first couple of years that I went to college during the summer in a parts bin near Styling, and as a mail delivery boy in Highland Park. The very first summer, I was a shop instructor at Cranbrook for young kids during the summer before I actually went to school. I was picking up some experience, especially in the fiberglass aspect of things, which I was just terribly interested in because it represented a medium to be able to build a body out of that was followed your exact design because it was molded. And so I had wanted for years to build my own sports car with a fiberglass body. And so I pursued that. I found a little Simca chassis, Simca car, a 1950 Simca car, one of my father's cohorts that he had been working with at Chrysler, that had been brought into to Chrysler more or less to as an Italian consultant to Ghia, and as an interpreter, was my man by the name of Paul Farrago. Farrago, who ran a small sports car shop in Detroit in the early 50s, and had built his own special car. Very nice man, comical at times, Italian, and he had a good bunch of friends that were involved in the sports car meets, and my father got involved that way too with some of the Chrysler show cars, with the DeSoto Adventure and the Chrysler Falcon. And so took up a great deal of friendship with Paul. I looked upon him as a great innovator. He could engineer things by the seat of his pants. He could build anything. He was the only person in this part of the country that understood Ferraris in any way, and his sports car shop was very successful. In fact, he became the chief service man, the complete service head for Falvey Sports Car Shop out in Woodward Avenue during this period of time.
Mr. Farrago.
Yes.
Yeah.
But then after, and he was always involved with Chrysler. My father more or less brought him into Chrysler to be the consultant when they got hot and heavy into the Ghia Chrysler show cars, because he again became a good friend of Luigi Sacri also. And so I purchased, Paul had started to build another car, but then he didn't have time. He had built a beautiful little Fiat car, and he didn't have time to pursue that when he got more involved in Chrysler in particular. He'd started to build a chassis of a Fiat, which was identical to the Simca. And I purchased this little four-door sedan from one of his friends. It was a Simca, and Paul had started to modify the frame of one of these cars, and I swapped him my body for his frame that he started to modify, and that gave, and I put my components from the Simca onto his frame, and then from there I built up a tubular frame, and by the fall of 1954, I had it pretty well built up. A basic running chassis. I moved the engine back and lowered it, and I had the basis of to pursue the body design for a full size sports car.
Incredible.
And then I went away to school. Then when I came back I went to Austria. Then when I came back in 1955. And returned to school in 1955 at Notre Dame. I took the towed the chassis down there with me and worked on it more or less as a thesis project for my graduate thesis in 1956, and I actually didn't do too much work on the chassis itself, but what I did do was to construct, as my graduate thesis, a quarter scale model of what the final body design would be, and wrote a paper on the whole thing, and that became the basis of my thesis, the finished fiberglass model. And
remember what grade you got on the paper?
Well, it wasn't a paper. It was a graduate thesis competition, and art students, and I won the highest honor, which was the Jacques Gold Medal of Fine Arts at that time. Well, I had been promoting with my professor, Mr. Beckman, and with my father, the idea of setting up in the future taking design at the University of Notre Dame and more or less establishing a transportation course for art students at the University of Notre Dame. And Notre Dame looked upon that very favorably. My father was getting very much involved with the university himself at that time on the arts and letters on the Fine Arts Advisory Council at that time too. So they were looking for involvement, and of course they were looking for funding from the industry also for anything that they could get that way, and it was just worked out wonderfully. He was always a great spokesman for the university, and they appreciated that, and his success at that time naturally was good for them, and we did manage to set that up for when I graduated in 1956. I was offered a position of a graduate teaching fellow, and I started graduate school, and I set up actually this course myself with a little bit of funding from Chrysler, it's the first actual class started in the summer of 1956, I started graduate school in the summer of 1956. During the summer of 1956, I had started to work on my chassis that I had there, and used the body design that I had established on the chassis. I started to finish the chassis as well as to start the construction of a full size body based on this design. During the summer of 56, as I have told before, my father had his heart attack. That didn't really put a crimp into anything as far as my activities were concerned, except that I was suddenly called home and had to take care of sisters and,
sure.
and whatnot
yes.
and family at home. Well, my mother kept a vigil at the hospital for quite a long time, whatnot. But then things turned out all right. My father went back to work finally in that fall, and I went back to school and started to teach this Notre Dame's very first transportation design course, based, of course, on a primary course in automobile design, in effect. And so it was the first type of industrial design that they had in any way.
Could we stop here?
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
So this was in 1956, in the fall of 1956, and I was teaching a basic perspective drawing course at this time, and I was taking my undergraduate or my graduate studies, and I was working on my car, which would be my master's thesis project, I was teaching under my professor, Mr. Beckman, the transportation design course.
Wonderful.
And I was taking the course at the same time, or at least I was being given credit for it.
You were teaching a section of it?
I was teaching the whole course. Yeah. There were 13 students that signed up for it, about 11 art students and a couple of engineering students. One of the engineering students has become one of my lifetime friends. That's Mike Clary.
C-L-E-A-R-Y.
C-L-E-A-R-Y. And as it turned out, his father had been in the advertising business at Ford Studebaker, was especially for Studebaker Truck, was held the Studebaker advertising account back in the 30s, and Mike himself had lived in South Bend and for years, but his family was actually living in Chicago at that time. But at any rate, we became close friends, and later on built cars together, race cars together, and stuff like that. He's currently an engineer at McDonnell Douglas in Phoenix, Arizona right now. At any rate, I taught the course and took the course, and it was a wonderful teaching experience for me. I decided I really liked that very, very much, and I had an opportunity to influence designers, and it was also the very first year was successful from the standpoint that we turned out two designers that actually went into the industry, and out of the very first class. The philosophy of the course was, and the philosophy of the school was at that time, that they didn't want to get into too much of a trade school type of atmosphere. They didn't want to get to take the undergraduate and start him from the time he was a freshman and make a strictly a automobile designer or transportation designer out of him.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, their philosophy was very much for at that time, and it still is to a great extent, in building a very solid overall foundation for their student, and then going on, they felt that he should go on and to specialize. They didn't want him to be too specialized until he went on to graduate years, or until the last couple of years of his undergraduate work. So the students that we took into the course, they were juniors and seniors by the time they were allowed to take the course, and it's. I think important even today that a student have a pretty good overall, well-rounded background before he specializes in something, for that matter. And but at any rate, that was the philosophy at the time. The course still exists to this day, and was taught for many years by Mr. Beckman himself. And as he learned more about it himself, he was not that experienced in automobile design. In fact, during the summer of 1956, and then that first year, or during the during the summer of 57, I believe it was. My father brought him up to Chrysler and actually took him in as a more or less a,
oh, really?
A designer himself to work there for a while to get the feeling of the whole idea.
Fascinating.
I recently did this myself just about 2 years ago with a designer from Brigham Young University.
Yeah.
It's just one of those
wonderful
fates. It's
mm-hmm.
it's necessary to
sure.
To do that. And so, at any rate, to proceed further, then it came time for me to graduate myself, and having taught the course for the fall of 56, and on through the summer school, actually during that period of time for the drawing portion of the course, and the funding came through to actually get to. We started out in just a couple of rooms, and then the funding came through from Chrysler to actually take the attic of a new building that we were in by that time, of the Arts and Letters building, and to convert that into a studio for the industrial design. At that period of time, I was coming to a close on my college career, and in fact, I was also wanting to finish the car that I had started, and I was building in the attic the full-size clay model. And during this period of time, one of the courses that I took that influenced me to a certain extent was that we had the University of Notre Dame had just brought to this country Professor Ivan Mastrovich, who was a very well-known Yugoslav sculptor. And Ivan Mastrovich, M-E-S-T-R-O-V-I-C-H, Mastrovich, very well-known Yugoslavian sculptor from the city of Savtat in Yugoslavia, and he was a C-I-V-T-A-T, I believe, I'm not sure. I've been there myself. but at any rate, he was a kind of a friend, foe, of Tito in Yugoslavia, and one of he had a very
Marshall Tito.
Yes, a Marshal Tito. He had very large political clout there, and was a Christian Catholic type Catholic. Looked upon as a great Catholic sculptor, and more or less was exiled, sort of, you might say, by Tito. And brought to Notre Dame along with all of his sculptural works, and he
really?
Did some, and then he had contracts to do some magnificent works in New York and Chicago, and they built a studio for him there, and I was very fortunate to be one of his very first sculptural students, and so I would do figure studies and things like that as a part of the sculptural training, and he saw that what I was doing as far as my full-size car design, he'd never seen anything like that before.
Really?
Not in oil-based clay.
Okay.
A big difference.
Okay,
yes, he knew of the clay, of course, and whatnot, but he had not seen...
Not the
oil-based clay type. Yeah. We worked in that messy water-based stuff, naturally, and in plaster and things like that.
His reaction
was when he saw this full-size car model, which was quite a wild-looking car, being sculpted in...
You were doing it full-size?
Oh, yes, I did it full-size. Yes, I had to, because I cast it later on and made a car out of it. But he saw this, and he was just amazed. And he was a very wonderful man, very nice old man.
He had a good relationship.
Mm-hmm.
That's good.
Mm-hmm. He always was kidding me about my stoop shoulders. I was coming to graduating from that, and I was finishing up the full-size clay model of my Simca design, and I was also getting very close to being inducted into the service, because I had joined the ROTC when I started Notre Dame, and I owed them, as it turned out, a 3-year commitment of active duty, and I was my call for summer training in the Air Force, for basic summer officer training, was deferred until that year of the fall of 1957. And I finished up graduate school then and went directly to Langley Air Force Base in Virginia and started my summer training for which is all that I had to finish from my ROTC program.
What happened to the full-size?
Well, I left it there.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Now
I
left it there.
But you finished your master's degree program?
Yes, I finished the program. The full-size clay model became the thesis for the...
That was accepted.
Yes, and that was accepted, yes.
But you asked them to hold on to the model.
Well, I knew I was going to come back.
Okay, see. Good.
And so I finished up the model and went down to Langley for the month or month and a half summer training.
Mm-hmm.
Came back to Notre Dame. Because I knew that I wasn't going to be called to active duty right away. I wasn't sure how long it would be. And so during that time that I was teaching the course there, I had kept in contact. I became good friends with a couple of young designers at Studebaker that was right there in South Bend. I'd always kept track of Studebaker styling while I was there. In fact, the head of Studebaker styling at that time in 1956-57 was Duncan McCrae, who was a friend of my father's a longtime friend of the family, his mm-hmm. fellow sports car enthusiast. And he hadn't actually worked for my father at any time, anything like that. But they'd been close. And a couple of the fellas that I would bring out from Studebaker actually to give a few seminars when I was teaching the course. I relied on a couple of fellows to come out and give demonstrations of sketches and show sketches of what was going on inside the business, and it was as well as my father would send down people from Chrysler to stimulate the students too, and we had a real nice course going there. It was just great. So I could call upon Studebaker. Yes, I had good outside resources now. I became good friends with a couple of designers that were there, and I decided, you know, that while I hadn't finished up my car, this would be, before I go into the service, this would be a great opportunity if I were to stick around be able to work on the car and give some help to my professor, Mr. Beckman, which he appreciated. It was free tutoring, and I got paid a little stipend for my teaching work when I was an undergraduate teaching fellow. So I worked out a deal with Duncan. Duncan says, well, I'll hire you because they needed designers themselves even at that time. And so Duncan hired me at Studebaker in the fall of 1957 when I came back from my summer training.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I don't know how long it's going to be. It's going to be maybe 6 months, or it might be a year, it might be, I don't know, before they call me active duty. He says, oh, that's okay, you can start as a designer. And so I worked right alongside my good friends, Del Coates and Emil Bocate, yeah.
Del
Coates, yes.
C-O-A-T-E-S.
Right.
And Emil?
Bocate, B-O-C-A-D-E.
Uh-huh.
Del became later on really the basis build up the CCS to practically what it is today.
Really?
Yes.
That was Del Coates.
Yes.
Right. Good.
So, and he had been both of them had been their training was at Art Center School in Los Angeles, which had built up at that time, So I started to work as Studebaker Packard as a designer in 1957 myself. I was put into Packard Studio. Del and I and Emil were the Packard Studio. We were the Packard Studio. About the only thing that I accomplished during that period of time, which turned out to be fairly short, was that we were working on the Studebaker Lark at that time to bring out the compact car, and I got a chance to actually contribute a little bit to the design of that, which was more or less the rear quarter and taillight design for that car. That's about all. Del actually had been there for a little while and done the Packard Hawk front end, which was in fiberglass, which he had done. so I was very happily working there for 6 months. And during that period of time, I was actually casting in fiberglass molds my full-size clay model
out of Notre Dame.
Yeah. So then, in February of 1958, I got my call to active duty. Now, they gave me quite a long period of time before I had to report,
mm-hmm.
and so I was called into the service to go down to Shepherd Air Force Base in Texas and to take summer training as a transportation officer. And so I had actually to report something about the 1st of August for 1958. And so I had some time in there, but I needed the time to finish my car.
Sure.
And so I quit Studebaker in February of 1962. And I went, I had the molds finished, and I dragged them up to Detroit on a trailer.
Oh.
Along with my I'd already driven the chassis because that was finished. In fact, I'd entered it in several sports car club meets and stuff like that,
okay.
and won a couple of trophies with it. And,
uh-huh.
But it was just a chassis, that's mm-hmm. all. And didn't have a body on it, but it was drivable. And so I had driven that up there before, and I trailered the molds, which was a 15-piece mold from this full-size clay. Up to Detroit, and I arranged to get a space, which happened to be a dual GIA because Paul Farrago was working there, and Gene Casserole operation with the dual GIA project. They gave me a little space to finish the casting of the body itself. And so I finished the casting of the body, and then I mounted the body on the chassis, and then I prepared the body for paint. And just before I left for the summer training, I turned it over to a shop here in Detroit to be painted.
Mm-hmm. And was Cliff Boss involved in any of this?
No, not with that particular project, or not with the teaching business.
Yeah.
So then I turned it over to the paint shop, and I went to I took my about a month's training, came back about the 1st of September. Finished, detailed the car itself, knowing that I was going to be called to active duty about the 1st of October, and to go to Korea, and for the first year of service, and so I came back home, finished the car up, took it down to Notre Dame. Dell and I photographed it down there. It became a feature article in Road and Track magazine.
Really?
in 1959, yeah. This was in the fall of 58, and I think it was in the April issue of 59. And it told all about it, and I got a lot of publicity out of Notre Dame magazine and stuff like that, and the story of it and the whole thing. And then I went off.
Notre Dame alumni magazine.
Yes, alumni magazine and newspaper publicity and whatnot, which I had gotten some before anyway, with this art department design transportation course anyway. So I took off then and went to Korea in fall of 58, and it was a hardship tour type of thing. I became a detachment commander of one of the Air Force bases there in Kunsan, Korea, and I enjoyed it. I enjoyed the service very, very much. I felt responsible, and I mm-hmm. felt it was a great opportunity, and to have a command of my own. My headquarters were in Japan. We were just a detachment.
Where?
My headquarters were in Japan, and
Japan.
I ran this detachment, aerial port squadron in Kunsan, Korea. Kunsan. And then that was a 13-month tour, and during that period of time, I actually had myself contracted a little bit with Luigi Segre of GIA to in effect become sort of a consultant during the time I was in the service. There was very little I could do when I went to Korea. It was initially cold there and everything else, and,
yes.
and I didn't have any kind of a drawing facility that I could really do any work. So that had to be kind of deferred until I was retransferred, until my tour of duty was up in Korea, and I was transferred to the San Francisco area for the next 2 years, and at Travis Air Force Base in north of San Francisco, and I loved that. It was great. I was a duty officer there, a transportation control officer, and that put me into shift work, and that worked out great because then I could pursue my my design work, as well as I could pursue a little bit of a racing career too at that time. And during the period of time that I went to Korea, I left my Simca car in the hands of a little Detroit sports car shop. They took it around and showed it all over, and my goodness, they even won some trophies for me.
Really?
With the car, and then the car was shown here at the Henry Ford Museum on the sports cars in review.
Uh-huh.
Simca saw it at that time, and they thought it was kind of a neat car, and they the officials contacted my father about it, and Simca was heavily involved at that time with Chrysler. And
by this time, Chrysler had taken them over.
Yes. Huh? And so
Ford had dealt them off, I think.
Right. That's right. And so Chrysler. So they saw the car there, and they had just acquired the name. They had just acquired Talbot, and they needed some kind of a wild car to promote this idea at the 1960 Paris show. 1959-60 Paris show. 60. That they wanted to promote the idea that they had picked up this grand sports car named Talbot Lago, you know. Tony Lago had been with the racing Talbots, and,
right.
and Talbot was a racing mark
mm-hmm.
to a great extent.
Mm-hmm.
So they asked me through my father if they would mind if they shipped it to Paris and showed it in the Paris show. I said, "Oh, please, by all means." You know, it was great for me. You know, and so they did that. Shipped it to. And I was in Korea at this time. They shipped it to Paris, showed it in the fall of 59 show, and then in the winter of 59, I was restationed back I was stationed back at San Francisco Air Force Base, and they shipped it back to me there.
Oh.
And not only that, but they gave me a beautiful Fiat Roadster too,
oh
for the privilege of having allowed them to do this. Oh my goodness, it was a fabulous privilege anyway.
Uh-huh.
But they felt that they actually owed me something, I guess. And so, I proceeded to race the Roadster and show my Simca around at various shows, and then I continued the contract with Segre in Torino as a design consultant, of which I would. I had my own little quarter-scale clay model. I was sculpting out models once a month. He would send me projects over. I would draw them in side view and three-quarter sketches, and rough out the clay model and take photographs of it
mm-hmm.
and send it to him. And I became sort of his American, you might say, consultant. He had designers himself, very good designers. As a matter of fact, one of them was Tom Jarda.
Oh, was he there at that
yes,
time?
And he was there at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Nevertheless, he wanted to kind of keep abreast of what the younger people thought and what design, where design was going in the States. So,
Segre was very forward-looking in that regard.
Very much so. He was a real nice guy, super guy, great big fella.
Was he?
And he married quite a wealthy Brazilian gal, and they were a neat couple. And raised a nice family and whatnot, and they became very good friends with my family. You know,
sure.
I liked Luigi very much, and Paul Fergo was always there. We were always together
mm-hmm.
when we were together,
mm-hmm.
and with Paul's wife and my mother and father, and my sisters,
mm-hmm.
and their kids were real little. But at any rate. So we became good friends. My parents became good friends with the Segres. I did have the opportunity then in 1960, I took a leave of absence, or I took my regular leave, of which one was allowed 30 days back in those days, when I was stationed at Travis Air Force Base. For the 1960 Paris show, I met my folks by hopping all the way across the country to and hopping all the way over to Europe on military aircraft. That was a nice privilege that one had, and I took advantage of it and went all the way to Germany and then met my parents and my sisters in Paris, and then we met the Segres, Luisa and Luigi. Had a good time there, and went down drove down to Italy, through Florence and then down to Rome, and then I flew back had to go back home, and they went, and I flew back up to Frankfurt, took my flight back all the way back around to Travis Air Force Base, and they proceeded to back home later on, but I got a chance to see the Paris show was on at that time, and it had been the first time that I had been back to Europe since I went there as a student. So at any rate, that was interesting experience.
Did you get to the GIA Works in Torino?
I did not on that trip. I had been there in 1955, and I did manage to get to GIA in 1955, and that was very important. To me, to be able to see that, and spent about a week there with a friend of mine in Torino, and got acquainted with Luigi a good deal more, and Paul Ferrigo was there at the time too. At that time, they were just completing work on the Carmen Ghia Volkswagen, and
that's their big success.
Yes, and which was a direct, absolute, intentional swipe off of the Chrysler Delegance, the car that was the show car, except with the front end, of course.
Your father didn't mind, though.
No, not at all. He didn't mind. And Giovanni Savinuzzi was the engineer that was and designer that was the guy that shrunk the Delegance and made the Carmen Ghia out of it. Nobody minded. It was wonderful. Savinuzzi was a great artist himself.
Yeah.
Others would say that the Delegance had nothing to do with it, but I know absolutely for sure that they said, well, didn't we do a good job? And I said, yes, because when I was showing the car at that time.
Mm-hmm.
But at any rate, that was intentional. And so.
They made no bones.
No, not at all, not at all. They did a good job of it. Like I said, they had to redo the front end because it was not a front engine car, but they did a good job on it. In fact, I owned the first one that ever came to the state of Michigan. I just loved it. It was a beauty. Yeah.
How many years did you have it?
Oh, I had it for just about a year. That was during the time I was building my sports car, and I needed the money to continue building my own car. And
I
sold it, or traded for it for a standard Volkswagen, and made a little bit of money out of it because they were in such high demand. Yeah. So at any rate, then I. When I got out of the service was in 1961, and by that time, then I raced the Fiat out there, and I showed the Simca, and I was doing the consultant work on this monthly basis, so mailing off tubes of drawings and pictures to Segre, and what resulted out of that, out of just the effort for that period of 2 years out there, was the Fiat 2100S was really. A result that did become reality of one of the designs that I did while I was there, and the Selene 2 show car, which was a Selene, Selena 2, which means moon. Selena means moon in Italian.
This was the second version.
The second version. Now the first version was a rear engine Renault that. That Segre had been commissioned to do as a show car for Renault. He had contracts with Volkswagen, with Renault, with Fiat, with Volvo, and several other contracts to continuously develop cars, show cars for them, as well as as any possibility of production models that may come about, and facelifts. And he had a complete facility that was constantly running Fiat 600s through his factory to make little dollops, and then they'd come out and be called a Ghia with the Ghia badge on them, just like almost like today, except it was really done at the Ghia shop in those days. The Ghia version of a Fiat, a little Fiat 500 or a Fiat 600 or a Fiat 1100, and constant contracts with Fiat as well as other coach builders did too. But Ghia was becoming one of the of the larger ones, and there were becoming fewer and fewer. Pininfarina, Ghia, there weren't, there was Bertone, there was, they were becoming, there had been very many, and they were becoming weeded down because they really didn't, and also at that time, Luigi started with a company right across the street with called OSI. OSI. OC was a combination of Olivetti, Segri, and Innocenti. Innocenti was famous for the motor scooters. They were right around the corner from Luigi's, from the Luigi's, from Ghia factory. And Olivetti was the typewriter people right down the right neighborhood. And Segri was the, yes, so it's OSI. They formed a consortium called OSI.
Forgive me, could you elaborate on the OSI connection?
Well, this was a little bit later on in the era I'm talking about.
Oh, okay.
But, no, it's okay. But Segri, in the, this was in the early 60s, in 61, 62. In fact, it was about that same time. It was in 1960 or 61 that that Segri got together with Innocenti and Olivetti and invested money in a new, updated, modern plant across the street from Ghia, and they named it. The three partners were named it OSI. OSI. The initial products. Products included a little special bodied Austin BMC product that was a small little sports car that they did at that time. Austin Healey.
Okay.
I think it was a small Austin Healey or an MG, one or the other, that was in that ilk, that they produced a special little body for. And then they did a, I'm not sure whether OC actually built the body for a Mustang or not, but they did a Fiat 1500, of which I had to do with the design myself on this consultantship basis. But it could well be that that OC did this, the 64 Mustang, because they stayed in business after Luigi's death, but at any rate, that's the beginning of the plant. Then I think they were sold out later on and ceased to become OC to whatever. I've lost track of that history, but Ghia today, under the ownership of Ford, does not own any of that plant that still exists across the street.
Does it?
No,
really?
No. No, they don't own any part of that.
But I mean, is the plant itself being...
Ghia?
No, I'm,
I mean OC,
yeah.
No, OC, like I say, Ford...
Oh, I see.
Owning Ghia today does not own any part of that plant, to my knowledge, or have anything to do with the plant that was OC across the street.
And is it still functioning OC?
I don't know. I don't even know that it functions today as OC in any way.
So there was a period there where they were sort of moonlighting on their own.
Well, not exactly. They just needed. They made a new consortium, new, not exactly a coach building works, but they made a production facility that they thought they could make some money on, naturally, by getting some larger production jobs. You see, the way they used to work those in those days was that, for instance, when Ghia did the common Ghia, they built the prototype car there at Ghia, Then they were rewarded the contract to do maybe the first 2,000 production cars.
Oh,
they did the same thing with the Renault Floride or Caravelle. They did the same thing with some of the other production body sports cars that they did.
This
like
would
the
be their payoff, in other words.
Yeah, this would be their initial payoff.
Okay.
Rather than and it would also be sort of the proof of the of whether it was going to be popular and sell or not,
sure.
That they would get the contract, and Pininfarina worked the same way.
Uh-huh.
Bertone also.
But now in the case of the Carmen Ghia, how did Carmen come into it, the bodywork?
Well, of course, Carmen was into it to begin with, to develop it the same way, that Ghia contracted with Carmen to do all of the prototype development through Carmen for Volkswagen.
Sure.
And so when they did the Carmen Ghia, then Carmen says, "Oh, I'd like to build that." So you start the production, and I think the first couple of thousand were done at Ghia, and then Ghia got the profits off of those, and then they shifted the production into Carmen, and they elaborated on it to do more of them, and it became then Carmen forever. And I believe that Ghia still got a royalty from it.
Oh, sure.
They did the same thing with Renault with the Caravelle.
Where were the Carmen works, by the way?
It's in Osnabrück.
Osnabrück.
Osnabrück. Is that where Carmen is? Wolfsburg is Volkswagen, and Osnabrück is Carmen. Billum Carmen, very nice man, and build up a beautiful plant and facility there to do all the special Opel bodies and, all of the special Carmen bodies that he does today, Volkswagen work. It was a very natural thing then that when I got out of the service in the summer of 1961. And returned home. I had this contract that I was continued with Ghia. I did very little else while I was in the service except go race cars and design cars, but I did also very much like the work that I was doing in the service as being a transportation officer. I learned a great deal there about loading airplanes and handling freight and traffic and working on the flight line and primarily in the air transportation business. I've always thought that it gave me a broader aspect of a business as a whole, and besides, it was fun. It was really, truly fun. So, but then I came back home. My tour of duty was over, and
still single at this point.
Yes, I was still single. Mm-hmm. Right, I never had two. Well, I had plenty enough. Lady friends and whatnot. But I never was quite ready to settle down.
No,
I don't think
at
all. Yeah. And so I came home and very short and continued my own Ghia contract. I lived at home in Birmingham with my folks, and my sisters were going to school then at that time. And just about that same time, unfortunately, that very winter, in the winter of 1961, unfortunately, we had a very disastrous studio fire at the home in Birmingham. My father was, for the most part during the day, away from home at Chrysler, and I was actually using the studio, of which he had built on a very nice studio by that time, onto the home. I was using the studio myself to do the Ghia design work, and I had a small model going at all times there and whatnot too. But we had not a very large studio, but a good enough size. And so we went away for Christmas in 1961 to go back down to my grandparents in Buchanan, And the studio was relatively new, and we called a technician out for heat service. It was very cold, and it was heated by a pair of small electric heaters, separately heated from the rest of the house. And so we had just had a service call to regulate the heat, or to work on the heat, to repair the heat for some reason, or one of the heaters was out. And we waited in the morning for the repairman to come, and he did, came, fixed what he had to fix, and got the heater going again. And we took off and drove to, with my family, drove down to Buchanan, which we did many, many times.
And you knew the route.
Oh, very well. And literally hundreds of times. But when we got down there, we got a call from our next door neighbors on that on Christmas Eve that we had a fire in the house, and it was really extensive damage to not only the contents of the studio, I mean, with all these drawings and everything. My father had an extensive collection of art books and all types of, quite some nice drawings that were there in the house, car designs and everything else. Mm-hmm. And it really damaged the house, so that we were out of the house for a period of 6 months while it was being totally redone.
More poignantly, you lost a lot of design.
Well, we lost a lot of design work, and it was put me out of the design business for a little while there. Yeah. With Sagri, and I got pneumonia about that time besides. Mm-hmm. When we moved into this other house that we managed to rent for 6 months. But it was quite a disastrous type of thing overall.
Very traumatic.
During the time that I was in the service, my folks got interested in boats, and the family hadn't been terribly interested in boating and boats, but my father got more and more hooked on it, and of course living in Detroit and around the water. And also, he did become a member of the Grosse Pointe Yacht Club. Mm-hmm. and he took up a little bit of boating. He had some friends that had some boats and whatnot there, and the family got more and more interested. Especially during the time that I was in the service, we hadn't been particularly interested before. But during the time I was in the service, my dad got really hooked on boating, and the family on boats, and my mother and my sisters and my dad would go boating, and they bought themselves a little 25-foot Chris Craft cabin cruiser, and docked it at the yacht club. And by the time I got out of the service in 61, my dad was thinking about really designing boats, and that
really
became a real big passion. I still wasn't that enthusiastic about it, but I soon got enthusiastic about it, and we started to really study up on boats and really played around with the designs and whatnot. And so then in 1962, and we started to make some contacts regarding designs in boats. And so in 1962, when my father ceased to become the head of design at Chrysler and became a consultant, we thought very much in terms of starting a business and going into transportation design, with using first of all my GIA contract to elaborate on that, and second of all to seek out going into a possible boat design. And we approached it from the standpoint that we didn't really know anything about boats, and therefore that we needed to learn more. And even though we had ideas about what they should look like from the outside, we decided to team up with a very qualified marine architect who did know about it, and who really taught us about it and kept us honest about about the design of it. And so with that combination, then I kept we got over the fire situation. In 1962, we actually rented a small studio nearby in the neighborhood from the architects, Luckenbach Architect, Luckenbach Associates Architects on Woodward Avenue in Birmingham, and that became our first actual studio away from home. I proceeded to work on the GIA contracts with a very close association with Segre, and my father proceeded to draw boats all the time, and to make business contacts to pick up some business, and so this was and he was starting to work away more and more from Chrysler, became more of a consulting business. He had his salary and everything from Chrysler, but was on a consulting basis. So he spent much more and more time in our new studio than at Chrysler. And by 1964, completely was disassociated from Chrysler. So during
was
this,
it a, was it a break that that he felt badly about, or was he?
No.
Was
initially he did. He felt kind of bad about it, of course. Yeah. But then, as it turned out, he thought that worked out for the best, that it was for the best.
Pressure.
Yes, all right, very much so. Yeah. It was a tough road to hoe. We never we never made it very easy or anything, but we started to pick up some articles, some publicity, and let it be known that our services were available. And of course, we had this pretty nice little solid GIA contract.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And so...
it was nice you had that.
Yes. In 1960, we had already contracted with to do some very minor facelift work with Brunswick Corporation on their line of small boats, we picked up a couple little Hatteras facelift account, and car-wise, we hadn't done too much except with the GIA situation at all, which was becoming, if we elaborated on that, we were doing one or two models for them a month, and with complete backup of drawings and everything else. And several cars came out of that, the Renault Caravelle, as I mentioned before, that was actually one of my designs.
Mm-hmm.
And we did the Fiat 1500, we did an elaboration of the Fiat 2300S, we did I did the Karmann GIA 1500, which was the replacement, or not the replacement, but was the larger Karmann GIA. A few Volvo designs and all kinds of miscellaneous stuff.
Mm-hmm.
During that period of time. And we started to get a little bit of publicity on boat designs. My father was actually doing some of the illustration work, and we got a couple of feature magazine articles, notably in Esquire, Popular Boating. And again, in Esquire magazine in December of 1963, on a series called, a series that we called, What Would They Look Like Now? Suggested an article to their automotive editor that we do a series on taking some of the old famous classic cars, such as Stutz, Duesenberg, Packard, and Mercer, and selecting those four cars, and do a stylized version of what would they look like had they stayed in business, pursued a classic image, and be revived today, and therefore what would they look like?
This is a series in Esquire.
Yes, in Esquire. It was just a big article. Diana Bartley was the article was the gal that wrote the article and submitted it to him. The editor, I can't remember his name. Yeah. At any rate, my father even submitted the illustration, the layouts for the article and everything. Uh-huh. He still very much remembered how to do that from his advertising days,
right.
And made three different proposals on what the magazine article itself should look like, look like. Oh, he had a lot of fun at that. Then he did the illustrations, and I did the designs for the front ends and rear ends of the cars and made the sketches for that. And we submitted that stuff, and it became just extremely, it went over terrific, because people at that time were starting to, in 1960, in the 1961, 62, there started to be a classic, a yearn for more of a classic look in a car. People were getting tired at that time of just a mouthy look. And they were all the cars were looking alike, sort of the way they are right now.
Right.
and there was a need for some new thought, a new personality, at least, to be given to the automobile. And my father felt very strongly about this. This is where he had started to, in prior years to that, for Chrysler, even to promote the long hood,
right,
short deck, and a little bit more of a classic radiator style. And we could see that, well, okay, the Edsel was a good example. Okay, it was a failure, and it wasn't very good looking, but it was an attempt a bit to revive that sort of thing in 1958.
Mm-hmm.
There were some other winds blowing. The classic cars were getting popular. People were starting to collect them more fervently and buying every one they could lay their hands on. We thought this was good timing for this sort of thing. It was a smashing success, and out of that very article, three of those cars actually, three out of the four actually became revivals that we both had an awful lot to do with. The first being the Mercer Cobra, which was a development for a promotional car, show car for the Copper Development Association. The second was the 1966 Duesenberg revival, trying to revive the old Duesenberg along with Fritz Duesenberg, who was the son of August Duesenberg. And the third one was became the basis of the new Stutz Motor Car Company of America, which my father designed a revived Stutz for them. And they happened between the years of 1964 and until he died in 1973. Actually, he was still carrying on the design consulting work for Stutz, which had actually come into existence about 1967, 68, something like that. Also at this time, by 1963, shortly after 63. People made contact with us actually they liked those cars, and we had Renwald, a model car company, a model kit company, contact us. They wanted to do a revival series in the model kit world, of which I designed many miles of drawings for them to make kit cars out of these this series. And we had the Mercer Cobra built at a different coach works at Cibona Bassano, because unfortunately in 1963, I can't remember exactly the date, but
Cibona Bassano, I missed that.
Cibona Bassano.
What's that?
They're a coach builder in Torino.
Oh, I
they were Cibona dash Bassano. Two names,
right.
Mr. Cibona and the Bassano brothers.
Right.
Unfortunately, at this time, just after we, or just before, yeah, just before we launched into this classic car revival business, our GIA consultancy unfortunately reached a bad turn, and that was that in 1962 or early 1963, I believe it was 1962. Luigi Segre came over to Chrysler. Came over to visit the country to Ford and Chrysler. He did work for Ford during this period of time too, occasionally. He came to visit and he knew he had some health problem, and he visited Henry Ford Hospital, and it was a and he passed up a simple appendix operation, and he was going to have it done here, and then he decided to go back to Italy and have it done there,
why the decision to do that?
Well, for one thing, the thinking is somewhat European, that you kind of hide those things. And so he went back to a private doctor that said, well, I can do it for you. Got peritonitis and died.
And the incompetence of the doctor that did it?
Well, I don't know. Who knows? I don't know. But it was a sudden, sad, shocking thing. And naturally, we were on the verge at that time between Segre and ourselves. This was in 62, 63. I can't remember exactly when it was. We were right on the verge. My father had talked Segre into saying, you've got to start a GIA of Italy, of USA.
Yeah.
And he wrote a letter back, of which I have, saying, yep, you convinced me. And they had talked about it for years, getting in business together. He says, you Verge, of course, now that you're free from Chrysler, getting free from Chrysler, you'll be able to handle this.
Uh-huh.
And but there was all kinds of concerns about doing that, namely union bringing Italian workers over and starting a GIA of USA, starting a coachworks here, which naturally the advantage was the economic advantage, plus the fact that they had the workers that could really do the things at that time that our workers couldn't, that there was no skill, no art left here to do that. They still had some art left, ability to do the beautiful things that they can do. So, and upon his death, we were left initially without any kind of consultancy. Although Luisa initially took it over, his wife, and we then dealt with her, and then she brought in De Tommaso. Oh, she brought in some other people first, and a man by the name of Jim Giacomo Gaspardo took it over as the president.
Gaspardo.
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 Yeah. Took it over, and actually, we continued then to do business with him. But it was not before we were kind of left without their consultantship, but we did this series for Esquire, and we had people then coming to us and to build these cars. And initially, since we weren't in with GIA right at that period of time, and since it was recommended by Brooke Stevens, who was a longtime friend of my father, that these boys, Bassano boys, along with Sibona, who had been the head of the metal shop at GIA for many years, and severed his ties with them and went with the Bassano brothers and one was the promoter and the other was a designer. Nice fellows.
Mm-hmm.
And we took the business to them to do the Mercer Cobra, of which we bought a Cobra, Shelby Cobra chassis and shipped it to Sibona Bassano, and they did the building of the first car that we did while we were in business together, which was the show car for the Copper Development Association.
Right.
It was all trimmed in copper and brass, and was the idea was to promote the automotive trim and whatnot to the industry.
Name?
It was the Mercer Cobra, right. Was what it was called.
Yeah.
And both of us went to Italy back and forth to oversee the actual building of it. Then the next project that we got involved in was the Duesenberg project, we did the same thing. Built in every case, we made quarter scale models of these cars and in our studios and designed every detail and made every drawings for their construction in full size and then shipped the designs and photographs and everything, detailed designs to Italy whoever it was, whether it was GIA or Sibona, would build the full size mannequin there and then we go over there and supervise the final detailing as well as the mannequin, perfection of the mannequin, and then they would proceed to build the body.
When you use the term mannequin, you're talking
mannequin about is a full-size model.
Right.
Now, we would do it in clay here in the industry here, or now we're getting to foam and things like that. But
yeah.
We would do it in clay. They would do theirs they would build a combination wood, plaster, sometimes clay. In the case of Sibona Bassano, they went to clay. A mannequin is something that they use to actually fit the sheet metal to. And so they use it just a little bit differently than we do. We use it strictly as a styling model to take molds off of or to take data off of. They use it to perfect the design of the full-size car. However, they also will go back and use it to, when they pound out their metal, they'll use it almost as a fitting form, too.
Oh, wonderful.
And so
especially adapted to European methods.
Yes, absolutely, yeah. Mm-hmm. And so it's somewhat, in some cases, an open structure, but it's a very elaborate open structure, and that the areas that need to be filled in, filleted and things like that, they're solid, but it's a skeletal type of structure. In the case of Sabato Bassano there, though, they made theirs a complete clay structure. Those two projects, especially the Mercer Cobra and the Duesenberg, really came to fruition from at least a well-known standpoint, from a publicity standpoint. The Mercer Cobra was totally successful as far as the car was concerned. It still exists today. It's in a museum. It's in the last I knew it was in the Black Hawk collection in California. However, I believe it's been sold to some a private individual since then. I'm not sure.
It was sold to one of the barons.
Well, no, he owned it before.
The baron
started that collection, I think. I don't know.
I mean, Miles Baron Jr. had bought the Blackhawk collection from Briggs Huntingham.
Yes, but then they donated part of the collection to the University of California.
Oh,
yeah. And
you think that's part of that?
It was. I know that it was. But since that time, it's been sold off by the University of California by the fellow that's the museum curator or whoever is the director of the museum. Yeah.
Okay.
They do have the other car, to my knowledge, which was done at the same time as the Duesenberg, which was our Bugatti. Now we rekindled during the period of time that we went into business, we rekindled, of course, our own enthusiasm for classic cars.
Sure.
And I got just terribly hooked on myself back again on Bugattis. I always thought they were ugly. When I was a little kid, my daddy would draw me a race car. It would be modern. It would have a modern nose on it. It looked like a Mercedes Grand Prix car at that time and not a Bugatti. It's one of those things. The mechanical beauty is something that rekindled my enthusiasm, and then someone out in Birmingham bought one, and the collecting business was just starting to get back into a big swing there. I heard one run, and oh boy, that got me.
You're hooked.
Yeah, and so my dad too, and so we absorbed all of the classic cars, reabsorbed them. My goodness, we lived with them for a long time, but we reabsorbed that stuff, especially the racing cars. We tracked down every lead we had and hung around the shops and whatnot of the classic car restorers and absorbed all the literature that we could reabsorb. And we had quite an extensive library on cars. And then also we pursued the boat business. However, the car deal was that during the time we were doing the Duesenberg, and it was the Duesenberg revival that struck our fancy that somebody was going to re-bring out the Duesenberg. And so we felt that we could do it better than anybody else could, and contacted Fritz Duesenberg in Indianapolis, and he made it known that he was going to try to revive the Mark. And so we did a complete job for them which we contracted with them to do. And then that went through a series of having to refinance things. And unfortunately, it did get to the beautiful prototype stage, and they had orders for the car. They had as many orders as they could fill within a year for the car. And the fellow that wound up that was enthused about it to begin with, finally backed out of it, the financing backed out, Fred McManus. He decided he'd like to go play with his horses more than finance the car. Initially, he was very enthusiastic. It kind of left everybody hanging, including Fritz Duesenberg and Milo Record that were promoting the idea.
Milo
Record.
Mm-hmm. I spell
that. R-E-C-O-R-D. Mm-hmm. They were, everybody was kind of left out. We took up rekindled an association, my father did during this period of time, with Dale Cosper, more or less, as a consulting engineer to us. And of course, he was a longtime friend of the family. And Paul Farrago, also became involved in all these projects with my father and myself on these revival or any type of consultant or these projects that we got involved with from a car standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
And we went through the Duesenberg project to the point of even and contracted GIA, and in this case they were working for us, we also took back up this consulting business with the people that were running GIA at that time. And on that basis, they owed us quite a bit of money while the Duesenberg was being built, and because they owed us for this consultantship, consulting business we were doing. And so we had the opportunity, and we're enthusiastic about the revival car business, we had the opportunity in dealing with L. Scott Bailey of Automobile Quarterly to get some publicity in his publication regarding the Duesenberg project. He led us to a man that owned some Bugattis on the East Coast.
Mm-hmm.
Among these Bugattis was the last Type 101 Bugatti, a chassis, that had ever been built by the Bugatti factory. It was new, virtually. It had been stored for a number of years. And this man, Henderson, purchased it shipped it to the United States. And he had it in storage in New Jersey, along with about 13 or 14 other Bugattis that he had in his possession. He made it known that he wanted to sell the car. And through Scott Bailey, we were able to purchase this chassis. It wasn't very much money or anything like that. You didn't have to pay too much money for these cars in those days, because everything was relatively still, hadn't got to the explosiveness that it's gotten to be now.
Yes.
There was a few cars available.
This was what year?
This was in 1964, 65.
Mm-hmm.
About 65. At any rate, we negotiated the purchase of it, and my mother and father and I took off for New York with a good friend of the family's to drive to one of my mother's friends to drive to New York. It was a good opportunity to get there. They'd always loved New York and whatnot. We started out in a drive with a Plymouth wagon that we owned at that time, and with the intention that we would stop off in New Jersey and pick up this chassis, because I had a trailer that we towed, to pick up the chassis and drive it back to physically take it back to Birmingham. Unfortunately, we got in a very large snowstorm. We got extracted the chassis from a barn, got that loaded on the trailer, ran into a snowstorm, had to leave the chassis and the trailer with a gas station there in New Jersey, right near the turnpike, and we proceeded to go on to New York and do our business and then come back, and it was just too bad of weather to pick it up and bring it back to Detroit. So the next weekend or so, I went up there with my friend Mike, who was the engineering student at Mike Claria.
Oh, yes.
who was in the service by this time himself, and mm-hmm. and stationed in Detroit as a tank arsenal engineer. We proceeded to go pick it up and bring it back finally from New Jersey. And then Mike and I shortened the wheelbase on it, actually from the 130 inches to the 112 that it wound up being. Shipped the chassis to Italy. This was during the time that the Duesenberg was being built.